We are glad that you're here today. If you're here for the first time, my name is Seth. I'm one of the pastors here. I know we have many people here in town for a wedding, right? Some people from Australia, other parts of the country, and we even have the young couple here. You guys are brave. I will refrain myself from, I'll just leave it at that. But you know, sometimes as humans, we can take ourselves a little too seriously, can't we? As Christians, sometimes we can take ourselves a little too seriously. Here at the church, we have a great staff. We try and have a good time and a sense of humor about things. And this morning is going to be a bit of one of those days. I hope that you can bear with me, okay? If you're here for the first time, please be gracious with me. This is not how it is every Sunday. We still have fun every Sunday, but the past few weeks, we've been preparing for a yard sale here at the church. And during the yard sale, we went through all kinds of closets here in the church and storage rooms, and we came across all kinds of crazy things, and some things new, some things old. But during the search and getting rid of things, David Chase, a good friend of mine who attends our first service, his wife Lisa is our office secretary. He said, "Seth, I will pay $100 towards your mission trip this October if you would wear that choir robe when you preach on Sunday morning." And so, I mean, I have standards. I have limits. Apparently, they stop around $100. So, David, so we'll see how this morning goes. It was difficult keeping a straight face during some of the message earlier, and you'll see why in a bit. But you know, here's the thing, though. Unfortunately, if we're not careful when it comes to religion, even sometimes, even religion can get a little bit ugly when we hold on to our traditions, when we are more concerned about saving face, when we're just going through the motions. In our text today, Acts 21, I tied this in, believe it or not, Acts 21 this morning, we have some Jewish Christians who are more concerned with keeping up with their traditions, more concerned with keeping up with things they're comfortable with than they are about caring for people. In these verses, Paul he's promoting something just a little bit different. He's promoting the truth about Jesus Christ, okay? And we have these Jewish people, these religious people at the time who make up false accusations about him and try to harm him. Now, I'm sure glad that doesn't happen in our world today, aren't you? Unfortunately, we don't have to look very far, and we find religious people who are set on harming others, who are talking poorly about others, even persecuting and killing people on the other side of this world, correct? Religious people can be dangerous. Religion can be a terrible thing if we're not careful. That being said, Acts chapter 21, I want to start in verse 27 this morning. When the 7 days, it's talking about Paul here, okay, and I'll explain this a little further in a minute, but Paul is in the middle of this 7-day ritual. When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who's teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." For they'd previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him, with Paul, in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. So Paul is going through these purification rites, trying to show Jewish Christians that he's not against Jewish customs. He's trying to bring Jewish Christians and Greeks together. And right in the midst of him trying to honor the law and the temple, some people come and assault him. These Jews are not from Jerusalem, by the way. They're from Ephesus, about 1,000 miles away by foot. And they've come there to celebrate the Pentecost. And they recognize Paul and Trophimus, who's been with him around town, and they know that Trophimus is not a Jew. Trophimus is a Greek. He's a Gentile, a non-Jewish person. He's been traveling with Paul. And you may know why, you may remember why, because they're bringing back an offering from these churches back to the Jerusalem church where things have been difficult, things have been hard. And they've seen Paul and Trophimus around town and they jump to conclusions. Should have been here last week for the message, right? Don't jump to conclusions, but that's what they do. They assume that Paul has taken Trophimus into the temple. They create a riot. I have to keep my hands down. I found out first service, I have wings. Yeah, I told you, we'd have some fun this morning. But they're concerned. Many of these people were probably part of the riot back in Ephesus in Acts chapter 19. They've been a part of this type of thing before. And this time around, they make two accusations against Paul. First of all, they misrepresent Paul's teaching. They do. They've heard some things, but now they're saying, hey, this is the guy who's going around talking down about us and our people, our church, our law, and he shouldn't be doing that. Now, there's a little bit of a thread of truth there. Paul's gotten impatient with the Jewish people. He's been going around trying to preach Jesus Christ crucified and resurrected, and these people don't want to have anything to do with it, many of them. So he gets impatient with the Jews and begins preaching to the Gentiles, the non-Jewish people. And so you can kind of see how they get these bits and pieces mixed up. He's talking to the Jews, or to the Greeks, so he must be talking bad about us Jews. That's what their mindset is. Galatians also, we have a little bit of things stacked against Paul. He's already written Galatians by this point. And in Galatians, we read words like this. You can't be saved by the law. By keeping the law, by trusting in the law, it'll only prove you guilty. Paul's also written 1 Corinthians by this point. We read in 1 Corinthians, he's talking to the people, the church, and he says, you are the temple. You are God's temple. And so they're hearing these things, and now they're misinterpreting, misrepresenting, misleading about Paul, taking what he said and getting these sound bites out of context. I'm so glad that none of the things I've ever said, little sound bites, have been taken out of context, aren't you? But they've jumped to a conclusion. Paul's teaching against our people, against our law, against our temple. This isn't the first time they've used these tactics. Unfortunately, it won't be the last either. We could go back to Acts chapter 6. You remember the story of Stephen, right? Acts chapter 6, Stephen is famously known as the first martyr. This is what they said about him. We've heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. They stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes. They came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council. They set up false witnesses who said, this man never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law. Spoke poorly about him, made up these false accusations about him. It's not the first place there either. We could go farther back, Luke chapter 23. Verses 1 and 2, when they'd used the same tactics against Jesus as well. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. They began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation. That same group of people would go on and say, hey, he said something about tearing down the temple and rebuilding it in 3 days. He's not talking about that temple. He's talking about his body, the temple. And yet they use these same tactics now to misrepresent, to mislead, to construe. Second thing they do, this accusation they make, they accuse Paul of defiling the temple. They've seen Paul and Trophimus walking around Jerusalem, but they fabricate these details to kind of play on people's fears. Hey, I bet he brought that Greek guy into the temple. I bet he brought some others in there as well. And you know what happens when that happens? I mean, we pay the price. The people of Israel pay the price. Surely he didn't do that. I bet he did do that. You know how murmuring takes place. It's taboo, by the way, to bring a Greek guy into the temple. It's forbidden, way more taboo than preaching in a choir robe on Sunday morning, or wearing jeans or shorts or flip-flops or all those kinds of things, right? You stay here long enough, we'll see what happens. But you cannot take a Gentile into the temple area. I've got a picture for you this morning. This is a picture of a model of Jerusalem, okay? The Temple Mount. And the big structure up in the top in the center is the Temple Mount. The rest is Jerusalem, kind of overlooking that. This is kind of what it would have been like in the first century, the time of Jesus, the book of Acts. And right in the middle of the picture is this temple courtyard. This is about 35 acres, by the way, okay? That big open area around the temple building is what's called the Court of Gentiles. Anyone was allowed in there. Jew, Greek, didn't matter. This is where Paul would go and preach. This is where Peter would go and preach the gospel as well, open to everyone. And yet right there in the middle, we see this large structure. It seems like a small building to us. It's not small at all. That's Herod's temple, by the way, known as Herod's temple. Not a small building. You could take the average high school football field, the track around it, the stadium seating around that, and all of that would fit inside the size of this building. Alongside this temple was this 4.5-foot wall. And just on outside of that wall was this courtyard for the Gentiles. Okay, anyone was allowed there. Didn't matter. Jew, Greek, didn't matter. Signs posted on that temple wall that said this, Death is on your hands. Penalty by death. Anyone that's not Jewish comes in. Archaeological digs have found signs that say, beware. Enter at your own risk. Take caution. This area inside, the Roman government even respected it. Even if a Roman citizen would go in there who was not Jewish, they would allow them to face persecution, to face the consequences. So they would tell their people, you enter there at your own risk. Well, beyond this wall, this great big building, the first part is called the Court of Women. Again, any Jewish person could go in there. Grain and storage areas around there, but any Jewish person was welcome there. The next area is called the Court of Men. Only Jewish men could be there. Beyond that is another courtyard. Only priests could go in there. And then we have this big building that's divided into two parts. The first section of the building was called the Holy Place. The priests would go in there and offer sacrifices. And then beyond this massive curtain, a little bit of Old Testament history for you, beyond this massive curtain is the Most Holy Place, the Holy of Holies. One time a year, the high priest would go in there and make sacrifices on behalf of the people. And here in Acts chapter 21, this group of people is suggesting that Paul took Trophimus, perhaps some others, beyond that outer 4.5-foot wall, at least into the courtyard of women, or maybe beyond. It's not true, but if it did happen, the penalty is death. And not just death for Trophimus, this guy who's not allowed there, but also for anyone who allowed it to happen. Paul's the only one standing there, and so they seize Paul and bring him out and begin to attack him. Says the temple doors of the whole temple area are shut. Well, they think at this point that the temple's been made unclean. It's been defiled. And so they've got to purify the temple. So to do that, they have to offer sacrifices and kill anyone who's been guilty of defiling the temple. So would have been successful. But in the process, they start this riot. And the riot police show up. And in the process, they arrest Paul. And in a very real way, Paul, his life is saved. Let's continue. Verses 31 again, down through the end of the chapter, down through 36 for now. As they were seeking to kill him, the word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. When they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he'd done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing, some another, and as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd, for the mob of the people followed, crying, "Away with him." So because of this riot, it gets the attention of Rome, and the soldiers come, and they come quickly. I want to show you another picture here. This structure is called the Antonia Fortress. Herod built this fortress. And it's built right on the edge. Just to the right is this courtyard of the Gentiles, okay? Just on the side of the temple. It also sits in the northwest part of Jerusalem. So they could look to the south, look to the east, and they could see Jerusalem. But they could also especially look right down into this courtyard of what was taking place with God's people. So people are watching, at all times, God's people. I have to tell you today as Christians, be reminded, people are watching you. You are the example. You're not the exception. But they're looking around, and they see this riot, and so immediately they're down there, and they're attending to the situation. 1,000 soldiers would be based out of this fortress at any given time. 600 of them were present in the building. And so soldiers arrive, they stop the riot, they arrest Paul, saving his life. They start leading him out of this area and over to the Antonia Fortress, trying to figure out who he is, asking questions. Some say one thing, some say another, and another riot ensues. So what do? They pick Paul up. And I got to tell you, it's so much fun. They pick Paul up, and they're carrying Paul through the crowd. And I just kind of picture, this is the original mosh pit, right? And they're carrying Paul through, and even the people around are singing, we will rock you. Yeah, sorry. Bad Bible humor, I know. But that's what they're doing, right? They want to kill Paul. They want to take his life. Did you notice the treatment of Paul? Did you notice what he endures? This is just a few things that happened to him. Rejected by his own people. He's been arrested without cause and imprisoned. He's been accused by false witnesses. He's been beaten. He's the victim of a secret Jewish plot. And then did you hear what they yelled at the end? Away with him. This is where the light kind of turns on for me. Where else have we heard this story? Sounds a little bit familiar to me. Jesus also was rejected by his own people, arrested without cause, accused by false witnesses, beaten, victim of secret Jewish plots. And then, as Paul's standing here, being led to the same place that 27 years before Jesus was led, and Pilate would ask, well, which of these two men do you want me to release, Barabbas or Jesus? And the people say, give to us Barabbas, release to us Barabbas. And the Pilate asks, well, what do you want me to do with this other man? And what do they say? Away with him. Let him be crucified. And Jesus would be condemned and crucified. The parallels don't stop there. In the book of Acts, which again is a sequel to the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, Luke seems to be intentionally describing for us what's happening to Paul. And we get five trials of Paul listed here. Here at the Antonia Fortress, later in chapter 23, the Supreme Jewish Council, later with Felix, then Festus, then King Herod Agrippa. We could go back to Luke, and starting in chapter 22, we get five trials of Jesus at the high priest's house, before the Supreme Jewish Council, before Pilate, before King Herod Antipas, and then again before Pilate following. The whole story is repeating itself. We can quickly learn that oftentimes, when people follow Jesus, eventually they will be persecuted. Happened with Stephen, it happened with Paul. I'm telling you, friends, when people follow Jesus, eventually they will be persecuted. And sometimes it's by the very people who are playing games with their religion. People who are trying to protect their tradition or protect the way they've always done things or protect their ritual or save face or protect the sacred cow, whatever it may be, religion, if we're not careful, can become quite ugly. Jacob, can you move forward? I think you missed one. Sorry, buddy. Okay, thanks. This story, besides that, is also chock full of irony. Irony, if you know what that is when, you know, something happens that you just never would have expected. Sometimes quite humorously, in fact. For instance, a psychic canceling an appointment due to unforeseen circumstances, right? Or a tow truck being towed down the road, or a fire station burning down, perhaps, or an auto insurance assessor in an accident on the way to a scene. Or maybe this one, the barcode sticker that won't come loose of the nonstick frying pan once you get it home. Anybody had that? You know, you take it home, it's, this is supposed to be nonstick. Why will this not? Yeah, Acts 21, a lot of irony, but there's very little humor here. The first thing I find ironic is this. Paul is at the temple trying to honor the law when he's accused of defiling the temple. Paul's trying to bring people together. He's living out his Jewishness. He's going through this ritual process, showing by example to Jewish Christians it's okay to continue to practice your Jewish heritage. Don't put your faith in that, but it's okay. And Paul is accused of doing something at the very moment he's doing something that would make it obvious he's not doing the something they're accusing him of. Does that make sense? I hope so. How ironic. Isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain on your wedding day. Sorry, I'll stop there. It gets worse that it didn't rain yesterday, right? No rain yesterday. It gets worse. I want to remind you of the purpose of the Jewish people to begin with. What was the purpose of the Jewish people to the Gentiles to begin with? I mean, this whole mess gets stirred up. This whole problem comes about because Paul is accused of trying to bring light to the Gentiles. That's the purpose for the Jews. We found some other treasures here at the church. Aren't those nice? The original headlamp, I think. But the problem is I don't have my glasses on. I can't see with these. But supposedly, I was told that if I could work this into a sermon, it would be worth another $100 towards my mission trip. So I hope Aaron and Sandra pay up. We'll see. You can hold them to that. But the whole purpose... They'll come off quick. I can't, you guys are blurry now. The whole purpose is these Jewish people are to bring light to the Gentiles, to bring the light of God to the Gentiles. And rather than doing that, they start playing games with their religion, with their traditions, with the things they were comfortable with. And Paul comes along and he's being the light to the Gentiles, the very thing the Jews were supposed to be doing. And they get upset and they try to kill him because he's doing what they're supposed to be doing. Religion, if we're not careful, can be a deadly thing, a very ugly thing. Isn't it ironic, don't you think? Okay, the last one, the third one is this. It's just a word that finds itself into our text this morning. It's the word defiled. The word is kaneo. It means to make the holy common. It's in the Greek, but it's where we get our word koinonia. Maybe you've heard that word before. We use that a lot when we're talking about fellowship. Koinonia means fellowship. Actually, koinonia means having things in common. So what they're saying is, Paul, you've brought one of those common people into this holy place, and you've made this holy place common. Paul, you can't do that. Well, Paul hasn't done that. They've jumped to conclusions. They've said he brought this Trophimus guy in there. This is a pretty rare word, this word defiled, this specific one. It's only used 3 times in Acts. I want to tell you the other 2 places real quickly. Acts chapter 10, verse 9 and following. Here's the story. Peter's been told, or actually he's having this vision after he's been told to go to the household of Cornelius, right? Tell them about Jesus. Tell them the good news of the gospel. Sees this vision, the sheet coming down from heaven, and there's these animals in there that are unclean. They're not allowed to eat them. And he hears this voice from God saying, take and eat. Peter argues with God, I'm not going to do that. I can't do that. And God says, well, wait a minute. Don't argue with me. How can you call unclean defiled? How can you call unclean what I've made clean? Peter quickly realizes he's talking about people, not just food. He continues to argue, God, I've never done that before. I'm not going to do that. And God again says, wait a minute, how can you not accept these people? How can you say that these people, these people are common when I've made them uncommon? They're acceptable now, Peter. You're to go and preach to them 3 times. It goes back and forth. But eventually Peter goes, the whole household of Cornelius is baptized. That same word finds itself into another area of the scriptures in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 9. The author of Hebrews writes about the story of Jesus Christ and his sacrifice on the cross for us. This is what he says, verses 11 through 14. But when Christ appeared as a high priest, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, I hope you're tracking with me, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify, how much more will that purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? The writer of Hebrews is arguing this. If this animal sacrificial blood made in the temple can take a common person and make them uncommon, how much more will what Jesus did for us purify us and make us holy and without blemish? Jesus Christ did this for us. And this is, just bear with me, this is where I circle back for another aha moment. Paul's been accused of defiling the temple, right? Paul, you shouldn't have brought this guy in there. He didn't do it. But even if he had done it, he wouldn't have been defiling the temple. The temple's obsolete at this point, right? The temple isn't necessary any longer. The passage says Jesus himself entered the holy place and made sacrifices obsolete. Jesus Christ, once for all, did this for us. He made the defiled clean. He made the common uncommon. He made the unholy holy. And again, the purpose of the Jews was to bring light to the Gentiles. And Paul's bringing light to the Gentiles, and these Jewish people get upset with him. The whole purpose of the cross was to make the common uncommon. That's what Jesus did for us. You know, following Hebrews 9 is Hebrews chapter 10, right? I got a few verses I want to read from there, just a little segue here. Every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. By a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. Do you know who's being sanctified? We are. Those of us who have a saving relationship with Jesus Christ, we are being sanctified. And it says we are perfected for all time. Because of Jesus Christ, the common become uncommon. Because of Jesus Christ, the unholy become holy. The temple wasn't necessary any longer. Paul didn't take this Greek guy into the temple, but even if he had, it wouldn't have mattered. Jesus Christ, for all time, at one time, perfected those who are being made holy. Paul was mistreated because he was offering something new and better. Stephen was persecuted and stoned because he was offering something new and better. Jesus was accused, convicted, and crucified because he was offering something new and better. Religion can be quite ugly if we're not careful. Religion can be quite destructive if we're not careful. When we seek to just maintain the status quo, when we want to hold on to our traditions, when we want to stay with what we're comfortable with and save face, forgetting why we're here in the first place, to bring light to the world. The Jews forgot why they were there, to bring light to the Gentiles, so that Jesus can make common people uncommon. Here's the takeaway today for you. Live uncommonly. Live uncommonly. Embrace the irony. What do I mean by that? We're called out. We're set apart. The church is called out ones. We're uncommon. Live uncommonly. Live in such a way that you bring light, that you shed light on who Jesus Christ is and how much God loves you. Embrace the irony. It will happen. Days will come, weeks, months, years will come when you will not expect what happens. Understand that as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus Christ, it's only a matter of time before you will face some persecution of some form or fashion. Live uncommonly, embrace the irony. I'm so glad that Jesus was willing to die for common people that we could be made uncommon. Aren't you? Let's pray together.